Now, more Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
We're just hours away from the NFL draft. I know it's an exciting day, right? Especially for those fans of teams who didn't give you much hope last year. You have hope tonight. We're going to talk about a couple of prospects in particular. I have been ranting and raving about the talent that is Abdul Carter for the last few months, and I think our next guest can kind of play off of that a little bit and hopefully back me up. We have Jay Paterno. He's a member of the Penn State Board of Trustees, son of Penn State legend Joe Paterno, and he's also the author of the new book, Blitzed, The All-Out Pressure of College Football's New Era. Jay, it's a pleasure to get you on. I really appreciate you making out time here on Draft Day. Thank you.
Great to be on.
Yeah, there's so much to get into. I do want to start with what I said a moment ago. I do believe for the first time in my lifetime, I think Penn State has the two best players in this draft. I believe Abdul Carter is number one, and I think for anyone that watches Big Ten football or followed Penn State throughout the year, you can see the extremely high ceiling of T.J. Warren. I think if someone comes up and says, hey, two best prospects came from James Franklin's program, I think it's a fair case.
There's no question. I mean, especially when you look at the versatility of both guys. I mean, you know, think about Abdul Carter, and we'll start with him because he's probably going to get drafted before Warren does. But if you look at Abdul Carter, this is a guy that for 2 years played stand-up linebacker. So he has that ability to play a stand-up linebacker. Last year, he moved to the edge position, and it took him a couple weeks to get really kind of comfortable and get into it. But once he did, he was a dominant football player. So when you look at him, this is a guy who, as good as he is, there is still tremendous upside for him as an edge rusher because he's only done it for a year. So, I mean, that's a scary prospect when you think about it. And then you have the ability to take him and have him play some stand-up linebacker here and there. And now when you can move a guy like that around, now you can get him on to running backs and pass protection where a running back's now got to block him. So I think there's no question he's a really a diverse set of skills that he brings to the table. He's got upside, is as good as he is. So that, to me, makes him a great, great, great prospect as you get into this draft. Now, you talk about Warren. I mean, what didn't the guy do? But to handle all that from the head up, I mean, he just had an incredible football IQ that, again, makes him versatile as to all the things you can do with him. He can be a running back, and he can pass protect. He can block as an inline tight end. He can get down the field, get open, beat guys one-on-one, and force a defense to match up two guys on him. So I think those two guys really, it's hard for anybody to argue that there are two better prospects than those guys.
I agree 100%. I mean, in my family, we're big Notre Dame fans, and I tried telling everybody, you better hope and pray that Abdul Carter does not play in the Orange Bowl, because this guy is going to be a difference maker. I am curious on your thoughts of where Abdul would go, because common sense says draft him in Cleveland, put him opposite of Myles Garrett, and immediately you have a day one contributor. You have arguably the best edge rush in the NFL. That simple, right? But nothing's ever that simple with Cleveland. As we get a little bit closer to the draft, it seems more and more likely that he would go to New York, and I think this would be an epic fail on Cleveland's part. I can't see why anyone would not want to put him opposite of a guy who they just gave a record-breaking contract to in Myles Garrett. I think it's a match made in heaven, Jay, in my opinion.
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for what Cleveland has on their roster or not, so again, that's something that's up to them, but certainly, you know, if you're not going to take him, you could probably trade down and get some people for him. But, you know, I think, you know, it's a quarterback-driven league. So with that being the case, you need to have a great quarterback, and you need to have great pass rush. And, you know, Patrick Mahomes looked very ordinary in the Super Bowl. Why? Because the Eagles' pass rush was just incredible that night. And that's your best pass defense. So if you're not going to get a quarterback that you think can change the fortunes of your franchise dramatically in that second spot, you better get pass rush. So, I mean, if I'm Cleveland, I'm looking at the quarterback list, I'm looking at the pass rush list, and I'm probably, because I'm biased, I'm a Penn State guy, I'm landing on Abdul Carter.
Oh, I agree. I agree with you 100%. I do want to get one more thought on T.J. Warren. When you take a look at the way the tight end position has kind of evolved, and we can go back over the last few years, I mean, you had Brock Bowers, right? Everybody was really, really high on Bowers, and we saw him go to the Raiders. They lined him up all over the field. We saw him at H-back. We saw him in the slot. We saw him at tight end. They can run a two tight end set with Michael Mayer. I mean, he's so versatile. When you look at T.J. Warren, does he mimic that same versatility? Do you believe that a team, wherever it is he may go, can line him up all over the field and he's going to be productive? Do you see that in him?
Yeah, there's no question. And the good thing about it is you can see that on tape, because Penn State did a great job of, he was a wildcat quarterback, he was in the backfield as a running back, he did all those things. So you see him on tape. The thing about him that's really interesting is, as I evaluate him as a guy who coached football for 22 years and coached tight ends for a number of years and had a bunch of guys go to the pros, so I know what I'm looking at. I look at a guy, they put him in the backfield, and his running instincts as a running back slash wildcat quarterback, he did an incredible job of knowing where the blocking was coming, setting defenders up and then cutting underneath kickout blocks or working inside, getting the hook block and getting outside. Just, I mean, he has an incredible football sense. So he'll be able to do whatever you want. I mean, he even threw passes. He did it all. Even quick kid, he did a quick kick on a punt, which that didn't go so well. So maybe that's not what you want him for. But all the other stuff, there is no question he can do it. And like I said, his work ethic, the way he takes care of himself physically, and from the neck up, he's a guy that can play over 10 years in this league if he stays healthy.
Again, Jay Paterno joining us right now, a member of the Penn State Board of Trustees, son of the legendary Joe Paterno, as we talk a little NFL. Jay, I do want to get your perspective on this conversation we had yesterday here on the show. We were talking about draft prospects that we really, really like. And for me, one that I've kind of fallen in love with over the last couple of months is Malachi Starks, the safety out of Georgia. And one of the things that stands out to me is the fact that he's a three-year starter in Kirby Smart's system, especially in the day of the NIL, especially in the day of the transfer portal. Does that play a factor going into the NFL draft, at least in your mind? I mean, are teams looking at this and saying, look, this kid could leave at any particular time, but he was a three-year starter for a school like Georgia? Does that play a factor in today's game?
Oh, I think it's going to in the future. I think people are going to start to look for the kind of loyalty and character that you have. Not the guys that jump around all the time lack character, but it does kind of display the core value system. A guy like that stays in the same place for 3 years, and I think you can say the same thing about Tyler Warren and the Penn State guys, but I mean, that I think is going to be more and more important. You know, if I were looking a year from now whether I'm going to draft a quarterback from Tennessee, who's now at UCLA, those would be question marks I would have as a GM. I mean, is he all in with us? Is he going to be a team guy? Is he in the locker room? So I think that's going to be really interesting to see how that data point plays out over the next couple of years when, you know, as we have more and more years of this stuff. But I think there's dramatic change coming in college football that'll kind of lessen some of that too, though.
Well, we did have the final court approval on April 7th, the House versus NCAA and the NIL settlement. How is this going to impact college football? And not only college football, but collegiate athletics in general.
Well, I think you're looking at essentially salary cap, which I think will settle down some of the jumping around because there's only so much money out there. However, I think if we're going to, the minute that's settled, there's going to be another lawsuit. It's going to be Title IX because a year ago, the administration that was in power in D.C. Said that the revenue sharing would fall under Title IX, so you would have to have pretty equitable distribution between men and women's sports. The current administration has reversed course on that and said, you know, we don't care. It goes to whoever you want to give it to. And I've consulted on NIL stuff with a group that works nationally. And what you're hearing from most schools is roughly 80% of that is going to go to football, 10% is going to go to men's basketball, 5% to women's basketball, and 5% for other sports. So I think it will impact women's sports at a time when women's sports is not having a moment. They're having a movement. You're looking at the interest in women's sports, not just basketball. Women's volleyball has gone through the roof. Penn State just won the national title, and that, and attendance and interest in those sports. I think it's unfortunate timing that politically all the emphasis has been on transgender athletes and not in terms of the money that's going to be involved in going to women's sports. And where's the money for all this revenue sharing going to come? At a school like Penn State, we're a break-even athletic department, so we got to find $20.5 million in revenue sharing in about 8 weeks or 10 weeks. So it's going to have a big impact in a lot of ways.
Jay Paterno, again, our guest right now, as we talk about a number of topics, and this is one that I'm really intrigued by, Jay, and I'd love to get your opinion on the idea. People tell me all the time, it's lawless. It's the Wild West. There is no structure. Is that accurate, or are we over... Is it hyperbole, I guess, the question, from what we're seeing from an analyst or a fan standpoint?
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, the book that I wrote is essentially a novel, but it is, because of all the consulting I've done, all the coaches I've talked to, it is all based on true stories. So when you read this book, this book is going to pull back the curtain on what's really going on, and you'll see in the book, and it's based, like I said, it's all based in reality. It is the Wild West. There's no rules in place right now. Now, that'll change with this settlement, and there'll be a new kind of setup to kind of enforce rules, but I think the reality is, until you just admit what we're doing, whether it's Utah, whether it's Penn State, doesn't matter, we are operating sports entertainment franchises on our campuses. So until we, and I'm an old school guy, and it kills me to say this, but you got to be real about what you are. Until we have an employer/employee relationship, because that's what it really is now, and until we have collective bargaining, there is no really structure to try and settle this all down and try and make some sense of it, to have some rational protections both for athletes and for the schools who are investing money in these guys in terms of training and a whole bunch of other things. So, yeah, it is the Wild West now, but I think there's going to come a time where we're going to have it all settled down.
And I don't know if this is something that you really want to get into or you want to share an opinion on, but I did see a headline of a clip about Dabo Swinney talking about a Super League in college football. I mean, is that something that is legitimately in the near future when you take a look at the landscape of college athletics today, a Super League for college football?
Yeah, I think you know, that part I'm not that as wild about, but I think that's realistic about where we're headed, because you know, why, you know, if Alabama and Penn State probably shouldn't be governed by the same rules that, you know, some lower division, a James Madison or an Appalachian State are involved in, because the money's different, the contracts are different. But I don't think that's necessarily good for the game. I just think that's the reality of where it's probably heading. And if you are Clemson sitting in the ACC, you really want that Super League, because then, like the NFL, all those television contracts now come under one roof, and we all get an even cut of it. Where right now, you know, what Penn State is getting from their television contract money is probably in the neighborhood of $60 million with the Big Ten, and then Clemson, the ACC, are around $38 to $40 million. So there's already an advantage there with them, with the Big Ten school. So I think they're looking, if you're an ACC school like that, you're looking and saying, we got to balance this out and make this equitable. And even though I'm a trustee at Penn State, and even though I like the advantage that we have, as a guy who coached for a long time, who really cares about the future of the game, I think we have to get to that point where there's a level playing field. And maybe we can get some of these schools in the West Coast to go back into a league or a division in the West, so they're not traveling as far east as many times like the Big Ten is right now. And I think we'd all be better off that way.
Jay, I do want to get into the book. You mentioned it just a moment ago, called Blitz. It's kind of a look inside of what's happening right now with college football. And I think the way you have kind of put this together is pretty fascinating, right? So you have a main character by the name of Ed Hart. He's the fictional head coach of Ohio State. But as you alluded to, everything in this book is based off of real accounts.
Yeah, no question. I wrote a book previous to this called Hot Seat, which was the same coach. But it was 4 years ago. So after that book was done, I had people say, well, what comes next? And what would it be like in the NIL? So I started to write this. And again, when I started to write this book, I said, if I write this as nonfiction, and I start to say this happened at this school, that lawyers are going to be involved. I don't want to tick off any friends I still have in the business, so to speak. And, you know, I don't want someone to blow my car up someday. You know, as an Italian, you know, that's always a fear that you have. Someone might put something in your car when you start it up. So I wrote it as fiction. So it is all – these are real stories. These are really what's going on, from the transfer portal pressures and the NIL pressures and what's going on with collectives, and then also the mental health pressures that are on these kids. Because now it's not just go to school and play football. And by the way, no one talks about the fact that they're students, but you talk about the pressures of the family saying, well, you got to jump from this school to that school because there's more money, and you're now our primary breadwinner at 19 or 18 or 17 years old. That's a lot of pressure, and schools are not preparing kids for some of the mental pressures that have come as a result of this. And they've become professionalized in the eyes of the fans. It's no longer a kid playing an extracurricular activity for dear old state. Now it is, oh, well, he makes X amount of dollars, and he's on social media promoting some product, so I'm going to go on a social media account and shred him because he threw two picks in a loss. So, I mean, all these things are combining, and it's making it a very different world than what coaches were used to even just 2 years ago.
It's wild. And again, the book, it's called Blitzed, The All-Out Pressure of College Football's New Era. Jay Paterno joining us right now, son of the legend Joe Paterno. Jay, I got to ask, obviously, about your father's legacy and where the Paterno family is at today. I mean, we've had the pleasure of talking to you and kind of seeing what you're doing in today's world. But how is everything else going for the Paterno family?
Great. My mom is still, you know, she's still going and she still volunteers. And she's spent roughly six decades of her life fundraising, not an official capacity, volunteering and raising money for Penn State, doing stuff for the state Special Olympics in Pennsylvania. She just, you know, if I live to be 85, 90 and my time comes, I just hope she gives me a nice eulogy because she'll still be around and I won't, because she just has that kind of longevity. You know, so, I mean, it's been, you know, I still live here. Like I said, I'm on the board of trustees, so I'm involved. But my mom's still involved. And you know, it's still, we have great pride in Penn State and what Penn State's all about. And we've always been committed to doing what's great for Penn State.
Well, and unequivocally, your father, one of the greatest, if not the greatest college football coach of all time. And you talk about the legacy of Penn State. It's an honor to speak to you just in that regard. And I can just hear it in your voice. A lot of pride. There's a lot of pride there.
No question. And look, the reality is this. You know, the integrity of the program, I mean, you don't coach somewhere for 46 years and don't have NCAA violations and don't do some of the things that get you fired in terms of, you know, with breaking rules and that kind of stuff. And he just, and there are generations of guys that came here and got a great education, had a great football experience, and that's really what this program has always been about, in that order, get that education. And even the last six, 7 years of his career, Penn State had the sixth best record in the country on the field, but was the only school in the entire country that graduated over 80% of their players and won over 80% of their games. So, or 78%, I think is the number, but you get the point. It was, they were in a league of their own in terms of combining on the field and in the classroom success.
You know, I was going to ask this question, but you just said something a moment ago that kind of sparked this thought in my mind. You talk about 46 years, you know, within one program. The way the game and the landscape evolves, now it's yearly, right? Year by year. But the fact that your father was there for over four decades, that has to be difficult for a coach to embrace kind of the changes that we see within the sport itself. And he saw several changes. I mean, that's got to be difficult.
Well, the thing about it is this, is as he used to tell us, and I coached for him for 17 years, so I saw it. You know, I was a player, I was a coach for him for 17 years, so I saw it from every angle. You know, one of the things that made him great at what he did, and it would have made him a great leader no matter what he did, there was a set of core foundational values. And those values are very, very important, and that's the basis of what you do. Now, how you get those things done and how you, you know, tactics change, but your core values don't change. And that's really what enabled him to succeed over so many years, and he was adaptable. I mean, years ago, when it was Skype was still something new, you know, here's a guy who was, you know, in his late 70s, early 80s, saying, well, how's this Skype thing work? What do? We go, well, you can get on basically a Skype call with a recruit and talk to him face-to-face for free. He goes, well, this is video conferencing, but this is free? Well, great, let's do it. People couldn't believe he was Skyping recruits, and he was jumping the gun on some of this. He's like, okay, tell me what I got to do. So he always evaluated. And when you look at a guy like Whittingham at Utah, very, very similar in terms of the core things that he believes in and the core things that he builds his program around, and that's why he's had so much success there as well. And I know the two of them on Nike trips used to talk a bunch. My dad had great respect for him.
Jay Paterno, again, taking out the time to join us here on Draft Day. Jay, I could sit here and listen to you talk all day. Unfortunately, we are out of time on the segment. Thank you so much for making time for us and coming on and speaking about the variety of topics that we just went over. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
So did I. Appreciate it. Anytime, Gus.
Excellent conversation ahead of the NFL draft and also talking about the landscape of college football. Jay Paterno, son of the legendary coach Joe Paterno, joining us here on Drive Time Sports. We've got to pause for just a moment. More coming up when we return. We are live from the Sutherland Studios, and we're back right after this.